welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is Now or Never, and we do have Tammy back with us. So thanks for coming back, Tammy. And
thank you.
Let me get through these obligatories. As you know, that debt is fraud. As you know, we need to continue. If we're going to understand what we need and, you know, what we need the Lord to help intervene and help our interposition, we need to learn. So learn, pray, and act as we appeal to heaven. The focus is all on the Constitution. In other words, what we need everybody to understand is we have to start holding public servants accountable. In other words, we have to hold them accountable to their oath of office because they're legally bound to support the Constitution. We're all, technically, every citizen is legally bound to support and defend that Constitution, this Constitution, I should say. And that means that we're legally bound to do that even with deadly force against enemies, foreign and domestic. So let's not hem-haw and let's not... You know, what do you want to call it? Let's not marginalize this. I mean, I don't want to marginalize the onerous responsibility, the burden that we have in making sure that we hold our public servants accountable. We hold each other accountable. So, anyway, I want to, you know, basically say that, and oh yeah, I knew there was one more thing. If you're interested in trying to establish a campaign to become an elector to support the choosing of a constitutional president, yours truly, then let us know. We're working with all sorts of people, or we're willing to work with everybody in trying to take back our election system, because when the party started stealing the election system, the part that they stole was the Electoral College. They instituted primaries back in 1856, and that's when the party started actually controlling who became the electors. And it was slow and gradual, but they've used statutes and regulations. And as we know, with the 12th Amendment, the 12th Amendment made minor changes to the Electoral College in the process. And we know that if it's going to be different than what it's supposed to be, there needs to be an amendment. So bottom line, that's where we are. That's what we're going to do. And we are in Massachusetts. It's not fall time, so that you don't have all the leaves turning, but it is winter time. And they are in the midst of the ratification debates for Massachusetts in ratifying the federal Constitution. The day, folks, just so you were caught up with us, we are on January 21st. It's a Monday. And if you go all the way down to Mr. Dawes, it's a good distance down. This is where he discusses, or he actually makes a discourse regarding commerce that I believe is of interest. So let's start from the top, because I think we covered part of this before. So let's go ahead and start from the top. Thank you so much.
As to commerce, it is well known that the different states now pursue different systems of duties in regard to each other. By this, and for want of general laws of prohibition through the Union, we have not secured even our own domestic traffic that passes from state to state. This is contrary to the policy of every nation on earth. Some nations have no other commerce. The great and nourishing empire of China has but little commerce beyond their own territories, and no country is better circumstance than we for an exclusive traffic from state to state. Yet even in this we are rivaled by foreigners, by those foreigners to whom we are the least indebted. A vessel from Roseway or Halifax finds as hearty a welcome with its fish and whalebone at the southern ports as though it was built, navigated, and freighted from Salem or Boston. And this must be the case until we have laws comprehending and embracing alike all the states in the Union. But it is not. It is not only our coasting trade. Our whole commerce is going to ruin. Congress has not had power to make even a trade law which shall confine the importation of foreign goods to the ships of the producing or consuming country. If we had such a law, we should not go to England for the goods of other nations, nor would British vessels be the carriers of American produce from our sister states. In the states southward of the Delaware, it is agreed that 3/4 of the produce are exported and 3/4 of the returns are made in British bottoms. It is said that for exporting timber, 1/2 of the property goes to the carrier of the produce in general. It has been computed that when it is shipped from London from a southern state to the value of $1,000,000, the British merchant draws from that sum $300,000 under the names of freight and charges. This is money which belongs to the New England states, because we can furnish the ships as well as and much better than the British. Our sister states are willing that we should receive these benefits and that they should be secured to us by national laws. But until this is done, their private merchants will no doubt, for the sake of long credit or some other such temporary advantage, prefer the ships of foreigners. And yet we have suffered these ignominious burdens rather than trust our own representatives with power.
I'm sorry, it's ignominious.
Ignominious. Uh-huh. All these new words.
Go ahead.
We have suffered these ignominious burdens rather than trust our own representatives with power to help us. And we call ourselves free and independent states. We are independent of each other, but we are slaves to Europe. We have no uniformity in duties, imposts, excises, or prohibitions. Congress has no authority to withhold advantages from foreigners in order to obtain advantages from them. By the 9th of the old articles, Congress may enter into treaties and alliances under certain provisos, but Congress cannot pledge that a single state shall not render the whole treaty of commerce a nullity.
There you go. So when you really look at a confederation, which is what they have, and which is actually what they maintained under the new Constitution, it's impossible to succeed and to really become competitive in the world of commerce if you don't have laws and centralized, the protections for the states in the Union. In other words, and it's interesting, in the first paragraph you read, they already identified the fact that China, as large of a country as it is, they had zero trade at this point in time. Zero. As a matter of fact, the Chinese people didn't feel they needed to get anything from anybody because they didn't think that the stuff that was being made from around the world was of any value. Because in some ways, they had been... they had been isolated for thousands of years, and there was, a little bit of infighting. The real infighting with Japan and the other Asian nations really didn't happen much, other than they did have to build, the Great Wall of China for defense. There were a lot of little things historically, but over time, they had the luxury of being able to truly improve processes, which is one of the reasons why the finest china in the world was at that point in time coming from China. And so lots of people wanted to go to China to buy their goods, but no, they had no desire to go and buy goods and ship it back to them. And so, if you look, some of the innovations that we got were from them. But what's interesting, this is so interesting, if you really look at how they had advanced in ways, because their true hardships with war and warring was really more internal than it was external. And so as they gravitated, and they had a predilection as a nation towards communal living. In other words, interdependencies, that everybody kind of did their fair share. The concept of communism was pretty easily embraced with the Communist Revolution, even though most people didn't want it. But the concept of just everybody having their place. As a matter of fact, they even have a caste system. There are certain people that are above others, and it's not like India or most places where, at least that I know of, that it's really that visible. It may be visible. I just don't know the nuances to it, because 9 times out of 10, that's how we usually divide ourselves, right? How you look. But but the caste system is that there are certain people who are to be served, who are better than others, and then there are others. So Ambassador Locke, and I think this was under Obama, Ambassador Locke went to basically represent the Obama administration going into China. And this was like the first time, you know, Obama was throwing the money everywhere else except for, you know, international and other things. And so Ambassador Locke, when he arrived, he had to carry his own suitcases through the airport and get to the hotel on his own. And there was nobody there to help him. And I'll tell you, the press in China had a heyday. I mean, they just made all sorts of political hay. Look at this. They're sending us a serf. They're sending us some slave, not some leader. A leader would clearly have an entourage and that type of thing. That was their paradigm. So they have these paradigms that conflict in some ways with Western society, but they do love liberty. They love the ability to be free. And so that's one of the reasons why I think there have been a lot of successes with some Chinese movements here in basically turning their back. Not on the culture, but on the communism, the governance, and those types of things. But anyway, anyway, back to this trade, though. For America to become successful, now you got to remember that The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith was written in 1776. And in that book, they had already had a good understanding of the American colonies under Britain. And the potential of America because of all the raw resources and so forth. And so Adam Smith basically laid it out in his book that if America could actually and efficiently move commerce from the interior to the ships, you know, to the ports and the ships and overseas and back and efficiently do it. The more efficient that America can do that, the more successful they will become. And so that was one of the things that, you know, was in their minds. And as a matter of fact, that's one of the reasons why Madison in 1817 or 1816 told Congress that they really needed to make improvements regarding the highways, waterways, and so forth. That way, when they were able to do it, actually Madison wanted an amendment. He said, go get an amendment so we can do these things. And so if they could have done that, then they would have really, with the government's help, improved the national commerce. But to be clear, that was not something delegated. So anyway, he kind of talks, you know, clearly how this is key and important for America to become far more successful, and so that the states could be more successful. They needed these types of powers in a general government, these limited powers regarding foreign trade, because they were a mockery to the world. Everybody was undercutting everybody else. And clearly, here's Mr. Dawes talking about the importance of using Massachusetts ships. They could build them better. How dare they use, you know, British ships and so forth? And so he was pointing out that, you know, and today it's the same thing. When we look at, you know, who's constantly making money? The people that move the commerce around the world, in other words, the shipping, whoever controls shipping throughout the world is making the money. Why is that? Because it's a subscription, right? In other words, you have to have something flow. Not everybody can move, you know, massive computers. So bottom line, those ships are going and they're going to fill up and they're going to basically go with a full load and they're going to make full dollars on what they're transmuting from one port to the next. And so the whole world of shipping, and that was one of the ways Britain had become the world empire, because they controlled the shipping. And they did for years and years and years. So anyway, lots of good stuff. Let's go down to it's General Thompson, where he talks about the convention. So let's go ahead.
Okay. Mr. President, I totally abhor this paragraph. Massachusetts has ever been a leading state. Now let her give good advice to her sister states. Suppose 9 states adopt this constitution. Who shall touch the other 4? Some cry out, force them. I say, draw them. We love liberty. Britain never tried to enslave us until she told us we had too much liberty. The Confederation wants amendments. Shall we not amend it? The convention were sent on to Philadelphia to amend this Confederation, but they made a new creature, and the very setting of it is unconstitutional. In the convention, Pennsylvania had more members than all New England, and 2 of our delegates only were persuaded to sign the Constitution. Massachusetts once shut up the harbors against the British. There, I confess, I was taken in. Don't let us be in a hurry again. Let us wait to see what our sister states will do. What shall we suffer if we adjourn the consideration of it for 5 or 6 months? It is better to do this than to adopt it so hastily. Take care we don't disunite the states. By uniting, we stand. By dividing, we fall.
Okay, so actually, they're taking kind of a position of dividing right here. And I'm sharing this because I think it's really, really important to know that Massachusetts was one of the early states to have a convention. There was a lot of arrogance in the Massachusetts debates. This is one of them where they say, we don't need this. Let the other states do it. We'll watch. Let's not go. And the anti-ratification sentiments were pretty high. As a matter of fact, it was so high that the president, Mr. Hancock, John Hancock, ended up interrupting everybody and towards the end, where they're about ready to give the vote of ratification, he saw that the Constitution wasn't going to get ratified. Samuel Adams was not in favor of ratification. And as a matter of fact, as Samuel Adams goes, many other men go. He was that kind of a leader. Same thing with John Hancock. So they saw this problem, and they saw, well, we'll get into, you know, some of these other points, and but as we get into them, you're going to actually see how some of the reverends really talk about this document as a gift from heaven. So let's go down into Judge Sumner on delegated power.
The powers proposed to be delegated in this section are very important, as they will, in effect, place the purse strings of the citizens in the hands of Congress for certain purposes. In order to know whether such powers are necessary, we ought, sir, to inquire what the design of uniting under one government is. Is it that the national dignity may be supported, its safety preserved, and necessary debts paid? Is it not necessary, then, to afford the means by which alone those objects can be attained? Much better, it appears to me, would it be for the states not to unite under one government, which will be attended with some expense, than to unite, and at the same time withhold the powers necessary to accomplish the design of the Union. Gentlemen say the power to raise money may be abused. I grant it, and the same may be said of any other delegated power. Our general courts have the same power, but did they ever dare abuse it? Instead of voting themselves, what's that stand for? Instead of voting themselves sixes?
Sixes, I think that is a pay, like, because you see the pound, so 6 shillings and $8, they may have voted themselves 12 pounds a day.
But there never was a complaint of their voting themselves more than what was reasonable. If they should make an undue use of their power, they know a loss of confidence in the people would be the consequence, and they would not be reelected. And this is one security in the hands of the people.
Okay. All right. So as we move a little further down, the Honorable Mr. Phillips talks about welfare.
I rise to make a few observations on this section as it contains powers absolutely necessary. If social government did not exist, there would be an end of individual government. Therefore, our very being depends on social government. On this article is founded the main pillar of the building. Take away this pillar, and where is your government? Therefore, I conceive in this view of the case, this power is absolutely necessary. There seems to be a suspicion that this power will be abused. But is not all delegation of power equally dangerous? If we have a castle, shall we delay to put the commander into it, for fear he will turn his artillery against us? My concern is for the majesty of the people. If there is no virtue among them, what will Congress do? If they had the meekness of Moses, the patience of Job, and the wisdom of Solomon, and the people were determined to be slaves, sir, could the Congress prevent them? If they set heaven at defiance, no arm of flesh can save them. Sir, I shall have nothing to do in this government, but we see the situation we are in. We are verging towards destruction, and every one must be sensible of it. I suppose the New England states have a treasure offered to them better than the mines of Peru, and it cannot be to the disadvantage of the southern states. Great Britain and France come here with their vessel. Instead of our carrying our produce to those countries in American vessels navigated by our citizens. When I consider the extensive seacoast there is to this state alone, so well calculated for commerce, viewing matters in this light, I would rather sink all this continent owes me than this power should be withheld from Congress. Mention is made that Congress ought to be restricted of the power to keep an army except in time of war. I apprehend that great mischief would ensue from such a restriction. Let us take means to prevent war by granting to Congress the power of raising an army. If a declaration of war is made against this country and the enemy's army is coming against us, before Congress could collect the means to withstand this enemy, they would penetrate into the bowels of our country and everything dear to us would be gone in a moment. The honorable gentleman from Topsham has made use of the expression, O my country. From an apprehension that the Constitution should be adopted, I will cry out, O my country. If it is not adopted, I see nothing but destruction and inevitable ruin if it is not. The more I pursue the study, this article, and study this article, the more convinced I am of the necessity of such a power being vested in Congress. The more I hear said against it, the more I am confirmed in my sentiments of its expediency. For it is like the pure metal. The more you rub it, the brighter it shines. It is with concern I hear the honorable gentleman from Topsham make use of language against the gentleman of the law. Sir, I look on this order of men to be essential to the liberties and rights of the people, and whoever speaks against them as speaking against an ordinance of heaven. Mr. President, I hope every gentleman will offer his sentiments candidly on this momentous affair, that he will examine for himself and consider that he has not only the goods of this Commonwealth under consideration, but the welfare of the United States.
Yes, okay. So Mr. Willard then joins in this conversation regarding this point. So go ahead.
Entered largely into the field of ancient history and deducted therefrom.
Forgive me. We're going to be going into a break right here. So why don't we hold off with Dr. Willard, and we will take this quick break. And in so doing, we'll be able to, you know, get a drink or take a quick pause. Folks, we're going to be right back after this quick promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so now we're going to get into Mr. Willard or Dr. Willard and his comments. And actually, I'll go ahead and do this.
Okay.
Because there's that Amphictyonic League, and I think that's an ancient, like Greece or whatever, but that's okay. You have the, I think it's Lacedaemonian, I think, down below. Anyway, when they get into some of these ancient civilizations, they come up with some pretty interesting names. But anyway, so Dr. Willard entered largely into the field of ancient history and deduced there from arguments to prove that where power had been trusted to men, whether in great or small bodies, they had always abused it, and that thus republics had soon degenerated into aristocracies. He instanced Sparta, Athens, and Rome. The Amphictyonic League, he said, resembled the Confederation of the United States. While thus united, they defeated Xerxes, but were subdued by the gold of Philip, who brought the council to betray the interest of their country. Now, he's making these points, but let's be clear. If the states who actually have the responsibility of keeping the federal government in check, if everybody does their job, then it won't go south. We will have a well-functioning, because all of the checks and balances, the way they are, it is, I don't want to say it's impossible, but look how far and how long we went as a nation. Even though they have been slightly violating a little bit, most people would have predicted. And as a matter of fact, I commonly look at Thomas Jefferson and James Madison in their taking a stand with the Alien and Sedition Acts. That is nothing compared to what's happening today. They weren't dealing with chemtrails. They weren't dealing with, spying and, controls and losing parental controls and, them taking and assuming more and more personal controls. It is interesting how even still to this day, we are still within grasp of pulling this nation back. We have not fallen off the cliff where we're at a point of no return. And folks, until we hit that point, we want to be here to help encourage and help build the movement in pulling this nation back. So Mr. Gorham, the Honorable Mr. Gorham, replied. Go ahead.
In reply to the gentleman from Uxbridge, expose the absurdity of conclusions and hypotheses drawn from ancient governments which bore no relation to the Confederacy proposed, for those governments had no idea of representations as we have. He, however, warned us against the evil which had ruined those states, which he thought was the want of an efficient federal government. As much as the Athenians rejoiced in the extirpations of a Lacedaemonian, did I say that right? Well, if we are disunited, a citizen of Massachusetts at the death of a Connecticut man or a Yorker, with respect to the proposed government degenerating into an aristocracy, the honorable gentleman observed that the nature and situation of our country rendered such a circumstance impossible, as from the great preponderance of the agricultural interests in the United States, that interest would always have it in its power to elect such men as would, he observed, effectually prevent the introduction of any other than a perfectly democratical form of government.
Okay, now he's not talking about Democrat as a democracy, but ensuring that the elections of representations and so forth. Okay, so
right.
We skimmed down a little bit. Mr. Symes wants to talk a little bit about guns.
Mm.
Okay.
I humbly submit it, sir, whether if each state had its proportion of some certain gross sum assigned according to its numbers, and the power was given to Congress to collect the same, in case of default in the state, this would not have been a safer constitution. For, sir, I also disapprove of the power to collect, which is here vested in Congress. It is a power, sir, to burden us with a standing army of ravenous collectors, harpies, perhaps, from another state, but who, however, were never known to have bowels for any purpose but to fatten on the lifeblood of the people. In an age or two, this will be the case, and when the Congress shall become tyrannical, these vultures, their servants, will be the tyrants of the village, by whose presence all freedom of speech and action will be taken away.
Okay, so, interestingly enough, because I do include the anti-federalists in these, so that you can kind of see how they're making these arguments, how they're basically coming out and saying, you know, this is going to be a real problem because, you know, we're not going to have any controls. Or, and to be honest with you, when you look at these assertions, you'll actually see that for them, if Congress did these things, you know, like the ravenous collectors, and they come around and they're really just ravaging the states, then if had that happened, then that would have been unconstitutional. So why would the government have to tax? So they make these assertions, oh, they're just going to tax, tax, tax. The reason government tax, and you should know this from being from Wyoming, that the reason government taxes is because they're spending money. Now, when you look at what they can spend money on, the federal government could not just go and spend, spend, spend. They can only spend on things that would actually be, you know, within their enumerations, to be clear. So when we look at, like, armaments and defenses and those types of things, that's within their enumerations. Now, one of the things that they can do, and it kind of goes to the ships earlier, they can create a law, because this is what America started doing. They started providing preference towards American ships. In other words, you know, if you're going to use a foreign or a British ship, then, you know, they would assess a fee. It's kind of like when the government actually started building their own Navy ships. They had to be built in the United States, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So they could start creating these advantages so that if the federal government is going to spend money, at least it's spending money on those things it needs that's within the enumerations from the United States and not buying it from a foreign nation.
Right.
Okay. So going into this next one, Mr. Jones of Boston wants to talk a bit about corporations. Go ahead.
Enlarged on the various checks which the Constitution provides and which he said formed a security for liberty and prevention against power being abused, the frequency of elections of the Democratic branch, representation apportioned to numbers, the publication of the journals of Congress, etc. Gentlemen, he said, had compared the people of this country to those of Rome. But he observed The comparison was very erroneous. The Romans were divided into two classes, the nobility and the plebeians. The nobility kept all kinds of knowledge to their own class, and the plebeians were in general very ignorant, and when unemployed in time of peace, were ever ready for revolt and to follow the dictates of any designing patrician. But continued the worthy gentleman, the people of the United States are an enlightened, well-informed people and are therefore not easily imposed on by designing men.
Okay.
The right of representation, concluded Mr. J, is much more just and equitable than the boasted one of Great Britain, whose representatives are chosen by corporations or bureaus, and those bureaus in general are the property or at the disposal of the nobility and rich gentry of the kingdom.
Okay, so based on the design of the Constitution, the representation would be based upon the people. Any person could be a representative. Any person could be. And you just had to get elected, right? In contrast, he points it out that in Great Britain, the representation is chosen by corporations or these, you know, community, I'll just say, like aristocracies. And that's what he was kind of alluding to when you talk about designing patricians. That's an aristocracy. That's the upper class when they're in there and they're basically taking advantage of the ignorant, getting them to wear masks. You know, they're taking advantage of the ignorant to say, you know, we got to demonize anybody that doesn't get the vaccine because we convinced you, so they got to be bad. So that is where we get, it's about taking advantage, again, of the ignorant. And so right here, he's really talking about this huge contrast because the representation in Britain was not based, and got to remember that the concept was 30,000 people to one representative. You had to live in that area. And so we may have had some boroughs in some of the larger cities, but most of America was, at this point in time, pretty well dispersed because most people were agrarian. In Massachusetts and in the northeastern area, that's where manufacturing started coming in. So in other words, less land, more people close together, going into factories to work and so forth. And so it was, I'll just say, I look at the way America was transitioning, the representation still being held at 30,000 was far better because it was at least done by the people instead of the House of Commons. It's done by the noble class. They choose who's going to represent them in the House of Lords. Not the House of Commons, the House of Lords. And they also get to pipe in on the House of Commons. But they exclusively control, this, like our Senate, they exclusively control the House of Lords. Now, they knew with the 17th Amendment they could put us in a bad position. The reality is that when we look at the 17th Amendment. The 17th Amendment was really just a bunch of wool being pulled over our eyes, but that's a story for another time. So let's dive into this next one by Mr. Pierce, Impost and Direct Taxes, which will also get into some jurisdiction. Go ahead.
But, Mr. President, if Congress have the powers of direct taxes in the manner prescribed in this section, I fear we shall have that mode of taxation adopted in preference to imposts and excises. And the reasons of my fears are these. When the impost was granted to Congress in this state, I, then being a member of court, well remember the gentlemen in trade almost with one consent agreed that it was an unequal tax bearing hard on them. For although it finally was a tax on the consumer, yet in the first instance it was paid by persons in trade. And also they consumed more than the landed interest of dutied articles, and nothing but necessity induced them to submit to grant said impost, as that was the only way Congress could collect money to pay the foreign debt under the regulations they were then under. And I fear part of the state's members in Congress, when this Constitution is adopted, will resume their own opinion when they can lay direct taxes. And as Rhode Island has always been against an impost, and as they have an equal representation in the Senate, and part of Connecticut will be interested with them, and the southern states having no manufacturers of their own, and consuming much more foreign articles than the northern, it appears to me we are not certain of availing ourselves of an impost if we give Congress power to levy and collect direct taxes in time of peace.
Now, the one thing that he didn't get into that really should have been brought up is where is most of the manufactured goods that are coming into America? Where are they coming from? If they're coming from Britain, they will have imposts. If they come from France, maybe not so, because foreign trade is controlled. And one of the things that Washington did, because they could have easily talked about this, because it's the same thing with tariffs. Thomas Jefferson applied tariffs when he came into office. The intent is to ensure that we're not rewarding bad players. Washington, because he was the very first president, and because we were such an infancy as a nation, he did not want to start poking nations in the eye that had far more maturity and had been around, where they could actually work intrigue with other nations and so forth, where they could gang up on us. So Washington, by necessity, took the policy of neutrality. It is every company, every family, every country has a right to ensure that they focus on their best interests. And if their best interests are not rewarding warmongers and evildoers, then you want to set, you know, limitations on trade with those countries. You don't want to send our goods there. You don't want to bring their goods in here. So having an open revolving door policy is nice, but it's also a way that nations get taken advantage of. So when we really look at how everything was going to move forward, there was a lot of conjecture. And as this gentleman's talking about regarding, you know, these articles coming in and who is going to be affected the most, that is all is because as long as goods are coming in from Europe, as long as goods are coming in from Europe into America, then it begs the opportunity for somebody to manufacture those same goods for a cheaper price. And nobody can do that cheaper and better than America. For the longest time, we were the ones because property and resources were dirt cheap. And so when we look at how we got into this mess, I don't want to dive into a rat hole, so I'll just keep it really quick. Our fiscal policies and the way we have basically subjugated ourselves to corporations, we have positioned ourselves to subsidize global communism on the backs of the American taxpayer. That's what's been happening. So anyway, so let's get into this juris.
While I am up, Mr. President, I would make some observations on what has been passed over, as I think it is within the orders of the House. The Honorable Mr. Sedgwick said, if I understood him right, that if he thought that this Constitution consolidated the Union of the States, he should be the last man that should vote for it. But I take his meaning to be this, according to the reasoning of Mr. Ames, that it is not a consolidation of the Union because there are three branches in the Union, and therefore it is not a consolidation of the Union. But, sir, I think I cannot conceive of a sovereignty of power existing within a sovereign power, nor do I wish anything in this Constitution to prevent Congress being sovereign in matters belonging to their jurisdiction.
Okay, so right there, hold on. So hold on right there.
Go ahead.
So he's making some references because this is really new to them. And he's talking about the Union as the federal government is the Union. But actually, the Union are the states. The states are the Union. The federal government is, quit using the word federal, because in some of the other debates, they talk and they refer to it as the general government. It is a government that serves the Union. In other words, they're there to protect the security, national security. They're there to make sure that with foreign trade, we're not going to be taken advantage of. They're there to make sure that when it comes to the international courts, that we'll be protected. Their job is to protect the sovereignty of the states and the sovereignty of the union, the collective states, all of the states, as well as each state. And so when you hear these guys kind of talking, they're actually looking like they're creating a federation, but they're not. And I think that that's just because one of the things that they've gone through, and I think we're going to hit this next, is with Colonel Varnum. He's going to get into delegates. So let's go ahead and finish this part. And then we'll get into what he says regarding delegated, because these guys keep on thinking that the federal government is going to do everything, that they're going to, you know, taxes for everything. You know, they can only tax for those things that they spend. They can only spend on those enumerations. So anyway, let's go ahead and go through this now.
Okay. For I have seen the necessity of their powers in almost all the instances that have been mentioned in this convention, and also last winter in the rebellion, I thought it would be better for Congress to have stilled the people rather than the people from amongst themselves, who are more apt to be governed by temper than others. As it appeared to me, we were in the disqualifying act, as in my opinion, we then did not keep strictly to our own constitution, and I believe such a superior power ought to be in Congress. But I would have it distinctly bounded that everyone may know the utmost limits of it. And I have some doubts on my mind as to those limits, which I wish to have solved. I have also an objection as to the term for which the Senate are to be in office, for as the democratical branch of the federal legislature is to continue in office 2 years, and they are the only check on the federal, and they, the Senate, to continue in office 6 years, they will have an undue influence on the democratic branch. And I think they ought not to continue in office for a longer time than the other. And also that if they conduct ill, they may have a constitutional revolution in as short a period as 2 years if needed. The Honorable Mr. King said some days past that the Senate going out by classes, if rightly considered, were not for but 4 years. Because one-third part was never more than six, another four, and a third two. Therefore, the medium was four. But I think that way of arguing would argue that if they were all to go out at the end of 6 years, that they were but 3 years in office. Because half their time, they were under the age of 3 years, and the other half over the age of 3 years in office. Therefore, his arguing to me in that respect was not well-founded.
And could he made it a little bit more confusing? Because I don't think he understood the whole point of continuity and so forth. And that's okay. That's okay. Mr. Varnum is going to speak about delegated powers. Go ahead.
In answer to an inquiry why a Bill of Rights was not annexed to this Constitution, said that by the Constitution of Massachusetts, the legislature have a right to make all laws not repugnant to the Constitution. Now, he said, if there is such a clause in the Constitution under consideration, then there would be a necessity for a Bill of Rights. In the section under debate, Congress have an expressed power to levy taxes, etc., and to pass laws to carry their requisitions into execution. This, he said, was express and required no Bill of Rights. After stating the difference between delegated power and the grant of all power, except in certain cases, the colonel proceeded to controvert the idea that this constitution went to a consolidation of the union. He said it was only a consolidation of strength, and that it was apparent Congress had no right to alter the internal relations of the state. The design in amending the Confederation, he said, was to remedy its defects. It was the interest of the whole to confederate against a foreign enemy, and each was bound to exert its utmost ability to oppose that enemy. But it had been done at our expense in a great measure, and there was no way to provide for a remedy, because Congress had not the power to call forth the resources of every state, nor to coerce delinquent states. But under the proposed government, those states which will not comply with equal requisitions will be coerced. And this, he said, is a glorious provision. In the late war, said the colonel, the states of New Hampshire and Massachusetts, for 2 of 3 years, had in the field half the Continental Army under General Washington. Who paid those troops? The states which raised them were called on to pay them. How, unless Congress have a power to levy taxes, can they make the states pay their proportion? In order that this and some other states may not again be obliged to pay 8 or 10 times their proportion of the public exigencies, he said, this power is highly necessary to be delegated to the federal head. He showed the necessity of Congress being enabled to prepare against the attacks of a foreign enemy, and he called upon the gentleman from Andover, Mr. Sims, or any other gentleman, to produce an instance where any government consisting of 3 branches elected by the people and having checks on each other, as this has, abused the power delegated to them.
Okay, so he's clearly laying out, but one of the things I noticed is that when you go into some of the debates, like Virginia really cuts to the chase. And when you really think about it, you look at all of the different states that really piped in, right? And you look at what happened in the Constitutional Convention. Going in, Virginia had a proposed plan. It was kind of an elaborate plan, but it set the stage. And they actually had some very ambitious things, like the splitting up of Congress and, you know, having bicameral, and how they ended up settling. And what ended up happening was, I think that those men that were there, some of them were only focused on maintaining this equal suffrage in the Senate. In other words, maintaining state sovereignty. That was probably half of the states there. They were more concerned about not trusting and not giving the big states full control so that they could be consumed. So they wanted to make sure they had a system that recognized and preserved the sovereignty and the individual sovereignty of each individual state. Because at the beginning, there was this concept that the states would become administrative. And therefore, the direction of the federal government would be by the more popular states. Now, as we kind of look at how these men articulate, I don't think, obviously, there's no Madisonians here. And as a matter of fact, this is why I tell you that when we read this, there's nothing here. Like when he's going through this debate on specifically on the delegations, it's very clear that they can only do these things that are delegated. They didn't need a Bill of Rights. Thank you for your time, Tammy, for contributing today. So as we move forward, folks, in Massachusetts, we're going to find that the eye is far more fixed on righteousness and what is in it for Massachusetts, because they were kind of a small state, a heavily populated, but a small state nonetheless. And they had their own unique interests. With that, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.